Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive functions. This show is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. These conversations will introduce mental tools that will empower you to shift your mindset for a successful life. And now, here's your host, Sucheta Kamath.
Welcome to the podcast. Good to be with you, Todd. How are you this morning?
I am doing great. Looking forward to this conversation. We have been trying for a couple weeks to get together with this lady. It's going to be a great conversation.
Truly, this topic is of deep interest to me. I care so much about learning how to learn and teaching children, adolescents and adults, how to learn, because once you know how to learn, you can learn anything. Just to tie with some of my personal experiences, you know, I speak 5 languages. But I will not take great credit for it because most of that learning language experience comes from immersion. And both my sons are multilingual, I would say. One, of course, through schooling, but the one has learned Spanish, one has learned French. My firstborn is deeply interested in language learning and linguistics. So he has dabbled into Arabic and now he's learning Hindi. So as I was getting ready for this podcast interview with our very special guest, I sent him this wonderful TED talk that our guest talks about called Ben the Irish Polyglot, Ben Lewis, who taught himself multiple languages. And so my son texted me back and he says, Mom, these are my takeaways. He says, Mom, it was a good TED talk. Basically, don't treat learning language like a subject of study. Don't get bogged down by rules, grammar, etc. Just try to speak as much as possible and make mistakes. Language is a communication tool. You should treat it just as such. It was so cute because I truly appreciate this approach that when you are taking on something new and difficult, it is going to be challenging, but don't be so threatened by challenges. And that's the message of our guest today. She is very fondly known as a female Indiana Jones. It's a great pleasure to have Dr. Barbara Oakley. She is a professor of engineering at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. She is a distinguished scholar, global digital learning at McMaster University and a Coursera's inaugural innovation instructor. Those who haven't subscribed to this course, I highly recommend. When it first came on board, I think in 2006, I'm not remembering, I took the course right away. So I was one of those 2 million people now, I guess, who have taken the course and benefited from her and her co-presenter's wisdom. Dr. Oakley's work focuses on complex relationship between neuroscience and social behavior. Her research has been described as revolutionary in the Wall Street Journal. She has published in outlets as varied as Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, the New York Times. She's an author and a co-author, but two of my favorite books that I'm using them as Bibles, this new book is The Mind Shift, which is fantastic. I highly recommend. And then also some incredible guides for students to learn to learn. So it's a great pleasure and honor and to have you, Dr. Oakley. How are you?
I am doing very well here today. It's a very, very windy day here in Michigan. And I'm just so glad to be on the show.
Thank you. So this podcast talks about executive functions, self-regulation. And I'm curious about when did my guests begin to attune with their own strengths and weaknesses as learners and thinkers? So from everything I read about your journey, you say that as a child, you were turned off by math and science as subjects not worth learning. But by the informal title you hold as a female Indiana Jones, I am extrapolating that you were quite curious and self-driven. So is that true about you as a child? And tell us about your own understanding of your strengths and weaknesses in spite of facing challenges in learning math and science.
I think part of it is growing comfortable with the idea of being uncomfortable. And I think that if you can do that, it can make a profound difference in how your life unfolds. A lot of times learning new things or doing something that's a little bit out of the ordinary is quite uncomfortable. And if you learn how to just kind of box that up, in other words, just do a little of it. And then, so you don't have to say, oh my gosh, I've got to learn this new thing and I've got to be spending 18 hours a day doing it. But just put it in a little box. You only need to do it for 20 minutes a day or whatever you choose. And doing something like that can help you to really move forward with things that at first are quite difficult. And the things that are hard, they're always uncomfortable when you first start. But once you begin building that schema, that neuroscientific framework for whatever you're learning, it surprisingly begins to become more and more comfortable.
Yes. And I think that's where you have really taken that understanding and shared with millions of people. So let's start with learning itself. How do you define learning? And what's the distinction between learning and learning how to learn?
I define learning as creating sets of neural connections in long-term memory such that you can draw on those sets of links and access them when you need information or you need to figure something out. Learning how to learn involves stepping back and learning about how you can more easily create those sets of links in long-term memory. That's metacognition, and it's a hot area of research. But essentially what it means is learning all sorts of tips and tricks and tools that help you to get information more easily in long-term memory in a way that you can withdraw that information when you critically need it.
It's interesting that in the field of education, we focus so much on learning, but learning how to learn almost falls by the wayside. And why is this not intuitive part of education?
So for a long time, we thought we knew how people learn, but we really didn't know because we couldn't look inside people's brains. It's only been in about the last 15 years or so that we have figured out or begun to see how the brain actually learns. So a lot of information about how we learn effectively is based on kind of very old-fashioned rules and ideas that often have nothing to do with how we really do learn most effectively. So it's understandable that educational systems often didn't teach about how to learn because a lot of what we did know about how we thought we learned was incorrect. So nowadays, we do know a lot more. Neuroscientists, cognitive psychologists have done fantastic research, really helps us to know better about how to learn effectively. But a lot of this information hasn't really made its way out into the school systems yet. And you have to also just remember that everybody thinks their subject is the most important subject, and that should be taught in all educational systems. And of course, I'm no different. I think that learning how to learn is sort of the mother of all subjects that people should know. But in the U.S. School districts, there are something like, 13,000 school districts, all kind of inchoate. It's really hard to mandate from on high. Yes, everyone will be learning how to learn. And as soon as you might mandate that, you're going to have all these people with different vested interests in their approaches to learning how to learn. So I can well understand that that's a fractious business. But for ordinary people living their lives, trying to be productive, trying to learn more effectively, there is great information out there that's solidly based on neuroscience. And that's what I highly recommend that people look into. I've been amazed. The last few weeks alone, we've had 50,000 new signups on Learning How to Learn. So since it came out in 2014, we've had nearly 3 million learners. And it's so funny because it's quite different than if a school of education had a course on learning, it would have had 2 weeks on how babies learn, 2 more weeks on theories of education, 2 more weeks on history of education, and then maybe towards the end of it, a little bit, beyond just theory of learning, which itself is often not practically useful, that would help people to learn. But people just flock to something that, like our Learning How to Learn course, which was very inexpensively made, but uses all the techniques within the course to actually help you learn more effectively while teaching you how to learn more effectively. And people absolutely love that. I spoke at Harvard and I was shocked that there were the room was packed. And come to find out, our one little course, made for less than $5,000, mostly in my basement, had on the order of the same number of students as all of Harvard's massive open online courses put together, made for millions of dollars with hundreds of people. So that just, it tells you people are, they
hungry.
They're hungry, starving for fresh information about how to learn effectively.
And most relevant information.
Yes. And you don't have to have some highfalutin, fancy production in order to, I mean, people kind of like corny, made at home. And, you know.
And I like your sense of humor.
Well, it's funny because we got this email from this one 12-year-old little girl. And she says, you know, I never understood that college professors could be so witty. And I'm like, yeah, well, we were witty because we had time to script it in and make it look like we were very witty, even if it took a lot of time to think that way.
So this is another interesting question along the lines of learning and thinking. But what is more difficult, teaching yourself how to learn or teaching someone else how to learn? And why so?
You can't make a blanket statement on that because it all depends on, like, if you're trying to teach yourself, are you very interested in it? Because if you're not, it's not going to be very easy for you to teach yourself this. And likewise, when you're trying to teach someone else, are they very interested in it? Because if they're not, and are you interested yourself in teaching about things? One thing I do have to point out, so I have great respect for tiger mothers who really want their children to learn all sorts of different things. And so they'll have their children enrolled in language courses and sports and learning musical instrument and all sorts of things. I so respect that. And at the same time, for me, I'm like too laid back to be a tiger mother. So I'm like a tiger mother with one paw. You know, I'm like, finally, I figured I will make my children do one thing, only one thing. And so I can get them to try out all these different, you know, musical instruments and whatever else they might want to try. But if they didn't want to do it, there was one thing I would make them do. And I decided my one thing would be 20 minutes of extra math practice using a program called Kumon, K-U-M-O-N. There's an equivalent, sort of equivalent, but it's much more up-to-date online, which is called Smartick, S-M-A-R-T-I-C-K. But I had my girls do 20 minutes of extra math a day. And you might think, well, how do you motivate your kids to do that? Well, I motivated them using every means at my disposal, including threats, rewards, and all sorts of things. But, you know, whatever seemed to work at the time. My daughter was just reminding me that when she was hit her early teens, I think we decided that she would get a certain monetary reward if she completed some of these packets. And all of a sudden, we're like paying all this money out, you know? But the thing is that people will often say, oh, don't give rewards because that won't build intrinsic motivation. Well, that's just not true. A lot of times you have to get the practice, the basic scaffold in. And whether you do that by getting a reward or not getting a reward or whatever, it doesn't matter so much as just getting that basic scaffold in. Because with our kids, so our older daughter was the perfect example of the awful child at math. I mean, she was totally pathetic. It was hard to get anything into her brain. She was really quite slow with it. And she just graduated from her residency in medical school at Stanford. So that little bit of extra practice made an enormous difference for her. She would have been one of those, you know, I just can't do math, as opposed to feeling very comfortable because she got that extra practice. And our younger daughter, the one that we gave the material rewards to, who should never have liked it, she loved art, became an artist, and now is going back to get her graduate degree because she's realizing that starving artist life is somewhat hard. And so her graduate degree is in statistics, which she lost. So it's all turned out very well.
So you make a great point about individual differences within learners and kind of tailoring of teaching that needs to happen. And sometimes people are not really careful in paying attention to those differences. And then if particularly buying too much too quickly into the student's resistance or difficulty or complaint, saying that I'm not a math person. So you leave them out of math. You know, I do not have a buy-in. When I, just like you as a parent, some of the strategies from my understanding of the neuroscience, I inculcated that I believe that you have to have certain amount of experience to know whether you like it or not. But in order to gain that experience, you cannot reject a new learning because it's difficult. So in my house, we had a rule to do something for 2 years. So for example, they started Taekwondo. And so of course, anything that requires practice is boring or annoying or difficult. So we said, okay, well, we're going to do Taekwondo for 2 years. And then you can decide whether you want to continue for 17 years or you want to say, okay, I have done enough. I have some experience and discipline. And that really helped in our family, that turned out to be a good commitment, like how to stay committed to something that just requires a lot of song and dance, you know, showing up for practices, having to do some homework, having to have the culture of that particular discipline of Taekwondo. That really helped a lot. Now that brings me to this next question. You kind of alluded to this, is what is neural scaffolding involved in one's learning? And how do we understand the concepts that are unfamiliar or we haven't heard? What kind of preparation the brain needs in order to acquire new knowledge? And what goes on at the brain level when we process information from working memory into kind of creating concept linking and eventually transferring that information into long-term memory? Sorry, this is a long-winded question.
And it's an extremely complex question, which I'll try to answer insofar as I can. So when you are learning, your brain has two major learning systems. One is the neocortex, and that is where most of the links of long-term memory are stored. The other is the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is this sort of temporary holding space. What happens is when you first learn something, like let's say you're listening to a lecture, and you're getting some information out of it. What's happening is that information is flowing into both those learning systems, both long-term memory and hippocampus. So neocortex and hippocampus. But in the neocortex, that the traces that are formed are very faint. They're like barely there. In the neocortex, the links, the neural links are stronger. They're much stronger. The thing about the hippocampus is, though, it can't hold that much information before it starts to kind of overwrite things and information will begin falling out, which in essence means it's very important if you really want to learn something to transfer what you got in hippocampus to your long-term memory. So what's often happening is when you're learning something, both systems are tuned in. They're both catching some information, but remember the neocortex is really faint. It's not very good at stuff. And when you take a little break, so let's say you get up, you go to the bathroom, go have a glass of water, take 5-10 minutes, something like that. What happens is your hippocampus is not getting new information at that time. And it turns around and it sends signals on to the neocortex. It's like, hey, guess what? Remember that stuff that you were hearing before? Well, here it is again, and I'm going to tell it to you even more. And so what the hippocampus is doing is transferring and consolidating the information that you've already picked up. Now, what is often happening when you're learning is your hippocampus is picking up that information, and when it has a break, it's sending that information on. And you can almost think of it this way. The first time that information lands in the hippocampus, it's like a flock of birds that comes up and it goes to rest on that branch. And then when you have a moment to take a break, what happens then is those birds take off again And then they fly and they rearrange themselves, and then they put themselves on the new branch. This rearranging is consolidation. And the more you begin to learn facts or learn information and start to see the bigger picture, the more that the information that's being rearranged in long-term memory has this kind of a new framework, a consolidated schema that you can hang information more easily off of. So it's that rearrangement of information as it goes into long-term memory or into the neocortex, and it's kind of constantly rearranging itself that gradually forms this wonderful framework. And this is why, let's say, I hear this sentence, я ничего не сказала. Well, if I didn't speak Russian, I'd hear that sentence and go, oh, well, what does that mean? But if you have the framework already, you can remember that sentence. You know what it means and so forth. So you already have the schema involved in those sounds and what those sounds mean. So creating schemas is a very important part of what we do when we form long-term memories. And the intertwining between working memory, the hippocampus, and long-term memory is so complex that there's still very much that we don't really understand. But that's sort of a quick overview of my understanding, at least, of what neuroscientists do at present understand.
And what's so lovely about your explanation, even this visual imagery, I think like the first time information flying through one system to another, it's like flock of birds, but they are disorganized, scattered. There's no pattern and there's no net to hold them all together in one place. But the simple repetition or the internal opportunity given or afforded through a break allows that information to organize itself on a branch like birds resting. And then you can look at those birds and say, oh, that looks like a family because there's a mama bird and a daddy bird and the two little birdlings or whatever. That ability to view the pattern is what eventually making meaning in the larger context of prior knowledge is all about. And I love this visualization because I think even if this simple science is explained to children, they can understand why they should give a break. And during the break, they should not flood themselves with more information that's irrelevant to learning. So one of the things that I hear a lot that children, particularly with ADHD, for example, they should do 20 minutes of work and then take 10 minutes of break. The problem happens, the 10 minutes of break is really not breaking from the monotony of learning so that you can be entertained, but it is literally allowing the internal mechanism to kick in while you hang back. So I appreciate this kind of approach to quickly just explain this aspect. So thank you for sharing that. That brings me to another very interesting process involved in learning is motivation. And you kind of said earlier, learning is not made equal for all. Not all topics will be of interest to all. But during formal years of learning, it's mandatory that you learn everything, no matter whether that interests you or not. So what is the relationship between motivation and learning? And can learner who is not interested in the topic or ideas or subjects use some type of self-motivation trickery to engage in learning because it's mandatory, because it's essential for continuing to next level of learning?
Absolutely. You can devise mental tricks to help you motivate yourself in learning. One of the best motivators in my experience, however, is external motivation to the extent that, let's say that you don't want to study, you're not really much interested in anything, and you're kind of like, oh, help me. I want to become more interested, but I just don't have any interest. So make me, somehow wave a magic wand and make me more interested in things. And sometimes people will ask this kind of thing. And my answer is often kind of a tough love sort of answer, which is, well, don't make yourself go to school if you're, you know, let's say you're at the university and you're studying something and you just don't care about it. Instead, just drop out and go work at McDonald's for a while. And you'll find that either you like this or it will give you strong motivation to actually make more of your studies when you do study. And I cannot tell you how many engineering students I've had, for example, who were in their 30s and terrible students. They had gone to college when they were 18. They should not have done that. Unfortunately, the university system encourages people who really have no place. I mean, they shouldn't be being encouraged to go to college. They're simply not ready for it. And so they had been encouraged, and then, of course, they dropped out and gotten debt and all that kind of stuff. But then later, when they got married, had a family, had needs beyond themselves, they suddenly realized, oh my gosh, I really, you know what? I should learn some of this stuff. And they actually do really well because they're very much motivated. So I think letting real life motivate you. There's lots of different ways to learn, and we shouldn't trick ourselves that the only way that learning takes place is by going to the university or learning in school. There's many different ways to learn, and we shouldn't expect that all people should always love typical academic approaches to learning. Of course, you know, that's my predisposition, but maybe people have other things they need to be learning at certain stages in their life. And I think it's incumbent on us to recognize their needs and that we are not going to be able to fill those kind of needs sometimes as academicians.
Yeah. And I think, well, as you're saying, the external motivation, so sometimes just that can be more enticing for, I mean, the option of like go and work in McDonald's is more experimentable for people who are in college. In high school, that's much harder. But I do suggest to parents that, you know, maybe a parent's idea that their son or daughter should take AP class. So, and that they are not interested or not able to handle it. And so the real solution there is to take a regular math or regular science. And that is not, can't do any harm. Because if the child is able to succeed at the level they are, that can also add great learning experience. So sometimes it's also a balance between the parents and children, particularly when the parents, students don't have complete autonomy on their learning choices, I guess.
My hero in science is Santiago Ramón y Cajal, who was an absolutely terrible student in high school and was actually kicked out of several schools. And he eventually won the Nobel Prize and is now considered the father of modern neuroscience. And he said, I was no genius, but he said, I've worked with many geniuses. And the problem with geniuses is they tend to make assumptions, jump to conclusions, and then when they're wrong, they're not used to being able to fix their mistakes because they don't make a lot of mistakes. So if you're just a sort of a normal student who just takes normal classes, it is still very possible that you could do way better in the long run than the super geniuses who are taking the way advanced classes and so forth. So yes, I think your words of wisdom to parents about just taking the regular progression of classes, I mean, it worked well for me. I'm now a PhD professor of engineering, and I certainly was not in the superstar high school classes. In fact, I was busy flunking my math and science in high school.
Which is very hard. So I call that those people opposite of you as PIH, peaked in high school.
Yes, and there are many of them.
Exactly. We don't want that kind of burnout. So you say hobbies often bring valuable mental flexibility and insight. If you're lucky, these insights can spill over, enhance your job. But even if they don't, your brain can be getting a workout. I love that quote. And I'm a big fan of hobbies and personal development on one's own time. And learning doesn't happen only in four walls of school. So my question is, how can a learner fall in love with learning? And how much of that is a responsibility of an educator? And how much of that is a responsibility of a parent?
That's a really tough question to answer because ultimately, it all has to go on to the student. I mean, the student themselves needs to have the wherewithal or the desire to learn. And Let's say, though, that a student has real attentional difficulties. So that's a learning disabled student who has real problems focusing. You know, do we say, oh, well, that's just your fault that you're not? I mean, everyone is different. And unfortunately, I do think you can build the attentional systems that you do have. Notice I don't say you can improve your working memory capacity, because as far as we know, about the only thing that can improve working memory capacity in general is just to go through a schooling system. And that does, like, if you are illiterate and have never gone through school, you will not have as big a working memory capacity as a person who has gone through a schooling system. But if you have gone through schooling, you can't make your working memory bigger. In other words, sort of what you can hold in mind temporarily. So I think that great teachers can do a lot to enhance students' desires to learn about different topics. Parents can also help. There are some just miserable, horrible parents by my lights who practically cause their child abuse by over just pushing and pushing and pushing on a certain topic. I think that research shows that that is, for many students, a real cause of burnout, that they don't do well in the long run that way. But there are a few who still prosper under those circumstances. So, you know, Beethoven, Mozart, and so forth. And so it's such a complex thing, but a great teacher, great parents who can really help motivate typical students to go beyond what they could have done in other circumstances.
Yeah, and to your point, I feel there's a way of modeling good practices. If the parents are themselves curious people, their curiosity can be very infectious. If the parents have hobbies, they have been lifelong learners, then their children are watching their father every Saturday, Sunday, being in their garage, you know, tinkering with the old car, or their mother, like, planting a garden as season changes. We have done that a lot in my household, learning many languages, puzzles, experimenting with cooking, putting on a show, those kinds of things we have done. I myself believe that learning doesn't happen in four walls of, and educators are not the only teachers. And lastly, I think, which I hear you talk a lot about that as well, is, as you're saying, what does learner's responsibility look like when the learner is only 9 years old? And that 9-year-old learner's, to me, is a commitment to do something, sticking with it, even when things are a little bit annoying, a little bit boring. I feel in this culture, one practice that children are not getting a lot of is burying boredom. I think they are allowed to exit boredom too quickly. And that can be antithesis to good learning habits, because learning is hard. And yes, it is going to hard is immediately going to be translated by the brain as boring. I don't have to do it. I don't like it. I don't have to do it. So it's kind of a creating some mental state and mindsets, I guess. So this brings me to that next question about role of attitudes. And you talk a lot about this and mindsets, in what ways they influence learning and in what ways they limit limitlessness of learning.
Oh, whoa, that's a good question. I'm trying to think. So certainly, if you believe you can't do it, you're going to have real problems trying to do it. But there's a problem, though. Carol Dweck's growth mindset is essentially you should teach kids to approach things with an open mind that you can change, and thus you can do it. The problem is that when you really look very carefully at teaching about this approach to kids, it doesn't make that big of a difference at all. And in fact, there was a study done of how well students did on a pre-college type test. And they found that it didn't matter whether you had a growth mindset or you didn't have a growth mindset. It just was, students did equivalently, you know. And so my mind is not really made up on how important it is to have a growth mindset. I think just having a teacher who models enthusiasm for the material, you can get kind of wrapped into it yourself. You were speaking earlier about how you try to model in your family this enthusiastic, open approach to learning. Sometimes I'm surprised when I look at old movies from our household. I'll be sitting there with our toddlers going, isn't this fun? This is so exciting. You know, and I'm like way over the top with enthusiasm and excitement. But that's really how I was a lot of the time there, just to get them. So, you know, I think a good teacher and a good parent can just model enthusiasm and excitement for a topic and kind of drag a kid willy-nilly into getting enough practice where they start getting it, and then they start getting used to it too. Because think about it. I mean, a bicycle. Who wants to learn to ride a bicycle? I don't want to learn how to ride a bicycle. I mean, you fall down, you skin your knee. There's all these things that can happen. But every kid sees that. But they also want to learn to ride a bicycle because they know that there's something really good that comes out of the end of this short, uncomfortable period. Well, learning is like that. It's just that the period of learning is sometimes much longer, and the kids don't see the success of riding along beautifully. And so they kind of have to be dragged along, sometimes unwillingly, through the more painful parts before they can begin to start seeing how they can fly.
You know, this reminds me of, you talk about this enthusiasm, like, yeah, you know, I'm a speech and language pathologist and a therapist. So a lot of my training was about very high level of enthusiasm to kind of influence those who are struggling and having difficulties. So isn't this great? Or animating everything. And then once I had my own children, it just became like doing therapy with your own children. You know? But I remember one of the things that has really made a remarkable influence on my children who are now 21 and 24, you know, the back end story and the front end outcomes, you know, connecting the whole, the big picture. So I'll give you an example where I taught my children in middle school, I think, how to make cookies, chocolate chip cookies. I used to make them. And so there was a David Libakovitz, I hope I'm saying it right, but his chocolate chip recipe, it's a very like precious recipe, and it was hard to find, and how it came about. And so I told them the story of this chocolate chip cookie recipe. Then we started making it. And then eventually we kind of said, imagine we are writing a letter to Mr. David and telling him what the cookie turned out to be. So each time we tried it, kind of giving them a little report card and giving them some giving feedback, which we never send, but it kind of became this. So you are the history student. When you read the backstory of the cookies, you are the chef, then you are the chemist, you are the physicist or whatever. Then you are a writer, then you are an evaluator, you are a critic. When you play all these roles, and then you are, of course, eating the cookie. So you're just a simple, amazing consumer. But I think just having to walk the kids through this experience of shifting hats in the midst of and having an experience was a very powerful way to get them engaged. And it's so interesting now that I'm seeing, because we were recording this during COVID-19 quarantine time, my son now, who is very interested in learning how to cook more complex recipes, and he will ask me the backstory of a recipe. Like, when did you learn it, mom? Who taught you? Is this your grandma's recipe or is this your mom's recipe? Why is it called this way? How do people in North India do it differently? I guess the restaurant recipe is different than this. In what ways is it different? So now he's become very interested in the experience of immersing himself in that learning how to learn, I guess. And it's so wonderful because to me now he can run with the baton by himself. There's no me propelling him to do anything, which is not that I was trying that, but isn't that what you're talking about? That self-sustaining ability of when you teach a man how to fish, they can fish and enjoy the fishing. That's the power of learning how to learn, I feel.
No, it absolutely is. And your son is the perfect example of that.
So how can teachers harness ideas from the neuroscience of how brain learns for the benefit of their students' education? And what are the general principles effective for learning and generalizing new knowledge in meaningful ways?
So I'm working on a book for teachers right now called Uncommon Sense Teaching, at least in its title form. So
I love it.
Coming out from Penguin Random House. And so I've tried to get those key ideas laid out in a way that teachers can digest them. But another way that people can learn more about how students learn effectively is simply by going to the Learning How to Learn for Youth, a massive open online course. There's the regular one, Learning How to Learn, which is on Coursera via Bankmaster. And then there's Learning How to Learn for Youth, which is on Coursera, but via Arizona State University. And the book that accompanies that is called Learning How to Learn. And it just has all of the key ideas about how your brain learns effectively.
Thank you, Barb, for mentioning those resources. And we can't wait for your book to come out. It's going to be incredibly beneficial for all the teachers. And you have to promise me you'll come back to talk to our teacher listeners. But I think these two resources that you have talked about, I will be linking in the show notes. So for people to surely explore for the youth learners and the resource guide that you have created. In closing, how are you doing in terms of your lifelong quest for learning how to learn? Is there anything you're doing special for your own satisfaction and kind of a little joy?
Oh, well, okay. So since we've got the lockdown, my whole attitude is to do things that make me feel uncomfortable. I travel all over the place, so I'm always doing everything. So I am in little puppy heaven right now on complete lockdown. It's an introvert's heaven. And so I am working away on my book and very happy.
Well, we cannot thank you enough for being here with us, sharing your wisdom and knowledge. But most importantly, thank you for taking the time in 2014 to put all that together. I know your story about the basement and the green screen and little antics that you put out, thinking that I don't even know if anybody's going to watch and look where we are. So I think that was something that needed to have been done. And the way you did it is really very empowering and powerful. So thank you. And it was such a joy to talk with you today. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
All right. That's all the time we have for today. If you know of someone who might benefit from listening to today's show, a teacher, principal, coach, parent, or student, we would be most grateful if you would kindly forward it to them. So on behalf of our host, Sucheta Kamath, today's guest, Dr. Barbara Oakley, and all of us at EXQ, thanks for listening. And we'll look forward to seeing you again right here next week on Full Prefrontal.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive functions. To contact our host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive functions, visit her website at CerebralMatters.com. That's CerebralMatters.com. Tune in next week for the next informative episode of Full Prefrontal.